it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Shamrock, brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at DirecTV.com. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by my co-host Matt Fortuna. Today, special guest Justin Williams, our beat writer for Cincinnati. And there are just a few narratives to unwind here with Notre Dame and Cincinnati. Justin, I don't know which one you want to start with. I mean, the transfer of Michael Young, receiver, obviously probably the biggest. when we're unspooling all the connections between Notre Dame and Cincinnati, do you feel like the Brian Kelly one is most applicable to Saturday, or is it more Marcus Freeman? I have strong opinions on that, but I'm curious how you see that.
From a fan perspective, whether they will admit it or not, the Brian Kelly thing is still a big thing. And like, there's some people that are still mad about the way he left. There's some people that just, now remember fondly, like, kind of, I guess, the first golden age of Cincinnati football, and Luke Fickell's now instituted the second one. But he just, I mean, Brian Kelly's influence on Cincinnati football was massive, and it's probably not what it is today under Luke Fickell, if not for Brian Kelly's three seasons there. So for good or for ill, like, fans care about beating Brian Kelly, whether they still harbor any anger towards him or not. But like, that doesn't, you know, none of these players care at all that they were in fourth grade when Brian Kelly coached at Cincinnati. It definitely, in terms of on-field impact, I do think Marcus Freeman being at Notre Dame, and even, you know, Mike Mickens, too, because they, especially on defense, they recruited a lot of those guys. They obviously coached them. So I think the emotional impact of seeing, you know, knowing they're on the opposite sideline, you know, even if it kind of strips away once the ball's kicked off, is I think Cincinnati hopes, it's still going to play a role, I think, in the actual on-field action, where the Brian Kelly stuff is purely just kind of fan interest.
Justin, you said these guys were in fourth grade when Brian Kelly was last at Notre Dame. Were you covering them? Were you in school then? Did you have any familiarity there?
I was slightly older than fourth grade, but no, I was not covering this. I would have been in college at Ohio University, not at Cincinnati, during that time. But I remember it because my entire childhood, you know, Cincinnati football was Bearcats football was not really a big deal at all. Like, you know, Cincinnati fans know this, but historically you had to buy football season tickets in order to get basketball season tickets, you know, when Bob Huggins was there and they were one of the best teams in the country. Like, you know, it no one went to those games. And then honestly, it flipped when Brian Kelly was there, because basketball had fallen off after Huggins left, and you had to buy basketball season tickets in order to get football season tickets. Like, that's how big of an impact Brian Kelly had. So I wasn't covering the team or really even in the city when that was happening, but like, you know, Armand Benz is on staff at Cincinnati. Tony Pike is still, you know, living his glory days in Cincinnati as a media personality. So that team is still very prevalent, you know, within the program and within the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think Armand Benz spent a couple years here as in kind of a GA role. But let's say, yeah, you've got Marcus Freeman, Mike Mickens. I mean, Mike Elston was there, you know. Jake Flint has been
Quinn so was
yeah
too.
Jeff Quinn, Jake Flint, longtime strength coach who's with Brian Kelly going back to Central Michigan, Mike Denbrock. It's kind of an overwhelming amount of connections, and so, I mean, I'm definitely with you. Like, Marcus Freeman matters on Saturday, like with what happens. Brian Kelly might matter, like, for people throwing stuff at their television back in Cincinnati, but like, has nothing to do with the actual outcome. So,
right.
I mean, what impact do you think the Marcus storyline has for Cincinnati players? Because I think after watching Jack Cohn go against Wisconsin last week and frankly kind of press and struggle. I don't think he processed that very well. How do Cincinnati players feel about Marcus leaving for Notre Dame? Like, and what kind of relationships do you think that have sort of been maintained there over the last year?
Yeah, it's tough to say. We asked Luke Fickell about it a little bit yesterday, and you know, he kind of admitted coaches understand this part of it, that you know, guys leave and go different places. But if you're a 19, 20-year-old player and Marcus is a big reason why you went to Cincinnati, and there are a lot of players on the team that, like, they went to Cincinnati because Marcus recruited them and they wanted to play for him. So, yeah, they understand it's, you know, a business to some degree. But it's got to be hard because, you know, I don't know if when you're that young you process the idea that, like, well, yeah, this guy's really good, that's why I want to go there, but that also means he might go to Notre Dame in 2 years or something like that. So I don't, you know, I think players understand. I don't know if there's, you know, we had one quote from Deshaun Pace, who, like, local Cincinnati kid, had other offers to go elsewhere, and Marcus was a big reason he came there, and we kind of brought him up to him last week, and he was like, I just think he shouldn't have left, and, you know, now we have to go show him that he shouldn't have left. I don't think it, like, they're, you know, chucking darts at a Marcus Freeman picture back in the dorm room or anything like that, but they want to win, even if it's because there's, like, this love and respect for him more than hate or something like that. But he just, his influence on that program and on the defense in particular is huge. So it's going to matter to those guys. But yeah, in terms of what it means on the field, I talked to Denbrock about that this week because he obviously knows Marcus really well and how he likes to call defense, and Marcus understands, you know, how Denbrock calls offense. But there's so much film and, you know, game breakdown now. I don't know, you know, you don't know what play they're going to call, even if you kind of know what plays they like to run. Part of me wonders if, and I don't know if this will be the case, like, if Marcus can, we talked about this in our back and forth, Pete, does Marcus go into the offensive meeting room this week and be like, you know, stay away from this guy, maybe go attack this guy, or this is where this guy's a little bit weaker, this is where we don't want to test this guy. I don't know if he does that, and I don't honestly know how big of an impact that might have, but I'm kind of curious to see if maybe Notre Dame's offense has some things they want to try because of Marcus's institutional understanding of the defense.
Justin, we had you on, I remember it was a Friday night when the news broke that Marcus was going to Notre Dame. It was obviously a cause for celebration in South Bend, and I think Pete asked you a question, something along the lines of, like, is there any way this doesn't work? And he obviously won the offseason, got a lot of good press, got a lot of good recruits. First two games, not so hot, but he's definitely rebounded, and that unit has definitely rebounded the last two games for Notre Dame. I say this with the knowledge that they were taking over a completely new program and starting from scratch, but what were kind of the early days of Marcus Freeman and that defense like at Cincinnati when he first got there in 2017?
Yeah, I mean, the 2017 season was rough. Luke talks about this all the time. They were 4-8, and Fickell constantly says we should have been, you know, 1-whatever that would have been.
That's every first year coach speak ever. Anytime yeah. They do anything positive, but
like they were bad, and the defense was bad, and you know he obviously, Marcus was, and Luke and Denbrock and everybody, the situation they were stepping into at Cincinnati in 2017 was far different than what Marcus was stepping into at Notre Dame this season, but the turnaround for them didn't happen immediately. It happened that second year. And part of it was getting some recruits in, but also part of it was like figuring out what they had and adapting to it. And that's what I think. I mean, as a recruiter, that might be Marcus's best strength. But if you're just talking as a coach on the field, his ability to, you know, take the guys he has and put them in the best position. Sometimes at Cincinnati, he would pull guys from offense and put them on defense, or he would literally move, you know, position that they had on defense. That's what he's so good. And that takes some time. And, you know, in Cincinnati, it basically took him a whole season to do that. You know, I was a little bit surprised at how much they struggled against Florida State, especially knowing what we know now about Florida State. But the fact that the defense has improved and Marcus continues to kind of tinker and change things at Notre Dame is not at all surprising, because that's what he did so well at Cincinnati.
I know we talked, I think, a little bit about sort of that 3-3-5 stack type stuff that he implemented for UCF at Cincinnati. And they've done some of that here to some success, but it's been interesting to sort of see him roll out, like, you know, game three, they play dime for the first time, incredibly effective. Then a week later, again, Wisconsin, you see a 4-4 front, which they hadn't played at all this season. Is that as surprising or as noteworthy as it is to us? I mean, is that just sort of par for the course for Marcus from what you saw at Cincinnati? Like, you just did not know what you're going to get from week to week.
Yeah, and that was always fun, you know, covering a Marcus Freeman defense, because the same deal, you know, they played Navy 1 year, like the year before they just got destroyed by Navy that first season, gave up over 500 rushing yards, and they came back that 2018 season, and they went to a 4-4, you know, broke that out for Navy and beat them like 42-0, and they'd spent a bunch of time in the off season like working specifically to beat Navy. The next season it was the same deal with UCF, that 3-3-5 formation, which Cincinnati has since stuck with. Like, they did that for UCF to kind of combat that, you know, fast spread offense that they run, and they broke it out for that game and hadn't played it in a game before that. So, and he was always doing that, even if it was something simple of like, you know, moving guys different odds and even fronts, shifting guys, moving the linebackers around. He almost always had some kind of unique wrinkle for the opponent, and seeing how, you know, figuring out within a game what he was doing and kind of how he was doing it was always fun. So again, not at all surprising to see him do that and have success with it at Notre Dame.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Justin, what's the mood around the program last 2 weeks coming into this game? We beat in the Brian Kelly story to death, but I mean, this is a monumental moment for this program. If they win this game, they have at least a shot to become the first ever Group of Five team to make the playoff. I mean, is there a sense of pressure, heightened pressure with this one? Do they talk about or acknowledge the opportunity that's in front of them? I mean, I know they're favorites according to Vegas, so it wouldn't be an upset if they did win. But if they win, like, this is an entire new conversation I'm not sure any of us have ever had during the playoff era about a team.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I don't think it's hyperbole to say this is the biggest regular season game in the history of Cincinnati football. And that, honestly, that, I mean, part of that's Notre Dame, but it, you know, if it was any top 10 team that they were going against, it would fit that criteria, because as much as the storylines and narrative is a big part of this, winning this is what, you know, unlocks at least the potential for them to have that college football playoff path. Like, they have to go undefeated, but they also have to beat some good non-conference teams, and, you know, they also have to have a bunch of kind of crazy stuff happen otherwise, which, you know, so far this season has been happening in college football. So, like, it's all kind of setting up for them to at least be in the conversation, and in order to do that, like, beating a top 10 Notre Dame team on the road is going to be a huge part of that. They knew that coming in this season. You know, those first two games against Miami and Murray State, like, no one talked about them because all, you know, all 9 months since the Peach Bowl, everyone's talking about Indiana, Notre Dame. Indiana, we'll see where they end up. It might not end up being quite as big of a win as they would hope coming into it. But the fact that for Cincinnati fans and for the program that they got to this fourth game for them, like fifth game for Notre Dame, both teams are undefeated and it's going to be a top 10 matchup. Like, this is everything they could have possibly hoped for. And now they realize they have to go out and do it, because going out and, you know, losing by a touchdown or playing really well and not pulling out a win, it might get them some kudos, but it's not going to do anything for kind of the goals that they hope to hit beyond this.
I guess 3 games into the season, I mean, do you know how good Cincinnati is or is not? Like, is this much how different is it from the team that finished last season against Georgia? I think for Notre Dame fans, maybe they watched the first half of the IU game before Notre Dame Toledo started, I think, or Purdue. And I think there's like, that was it. Cause I think IU sort of, we know IU is coming back to earth pretty forcefully right now, but, do you have a sense of how good Cincinnati is?
Yeah. I think they're really good. And, you know, I don't think Indiana's world beaters by any stretch, but the fact that they could go on the road against a Big Ten team. And that's the whole deal. Like, I realize Cincinnati's going to the Big 12 in a couple years. I realize they've kind of punched above their weight as a Group of Five program. But, you know, they're still have the constraints of a Group of Five program right now. They go on the road to a Big Ten team, get down 14-0, and, like, honestly didn't flinch and end up winning the game comfortably by 14. That, to me, is a sign that, yeah, this team's really solid. The way they played against Georgia in the Peach Bowl. I know Georgia had some guys out, but so did Cincinnati. Had two All-American defensive backs out. They had their starting running back out. They were depleted, too, and honestly, they should have won that game. You know, if their left tackle doesn't get ejected right before halftime, they probably do win that game. So I do think they're really good. Last year was kind of tough because we, you know, same thing with you guys. We couldn't really be around the team at all, so it's hard to get a good handle. I think last year's defense, we're starting to maybe see it this year. I think last year's defense was extremely good, and they've probably dropped back a little bit, partly because of Marcus leaving, but also just partly because of some of the James Wiggins, Derek Forrest, some of the guys they lost. But I think the offense has a chance this season to actually be better because of some of Desmond Ridder's improvements. So that might balance out a little bit. But, you know, you can be a really good team and go into Notre Dame and lose to a top 10 Notre Dame program. So, you know, it'll be interesting at the end of the season to kind of look back and see where they are. But for anyone that has any lingering doubts that this is a top 10 really good program, like, they can probably put a lot of those to bed by showing well and winning in South Bend, as difficult as that's going to be.
Justin, what is different about this defense under Mike Tressel?
So, he talked all offseason like he didn't want to come in and change much. You know, that they lost their two starting safeties but had two really good backups coming in. And, you know, they lost a linebacker but seemed to replace them with good. They had a lot coming back that was really talented. So he was kind of like, how do I enhance or augment this defense that's already really good? He's been a big focus on pre-snap recognition. You know, a guy like Darian Beavers, who's played really well and is going to go play in the NFL next year, he's talked a lot about kind of the benefit and impact that's had on him is trying to pick up things pre-snap and add that to his game. But Tressel stuck with the 3-3-5, you know, thus far for the most part. They went four down a little bit against Indiana because they were having some success running the ball. But it looks a lot similar. I think he's blitzed a little bit less than Marcus likes to, maybe played a little bit less man, you know, straight press man-to-man than Marcus did here, although it seems like Marcus is playing a little bit less man-to-man at Notre Dame this season too. So there are some differences, some tweaks, but just kind of the basic framework and scheme and structure of the defense looks very similar, especially in that Indiana game where they were forcing four turnovers. Like, it looked like a Marcus Freeman defense for the most part.
I want to get into the offense a little bit because Ridder is such an interesting talent to me. I think when the season started, you were looking at Slovis at USC or Howell at North Carolina as the best quarterback Notre Dame was going to play. And like a month into the season, I'm not so sure it's Ridder. What makes him good? What kind of, I guess, journey was he on at Cincinnati? Because I don't, you know, when he got there, I'm not sure he was seen as like this sure thing. Why is he so good, and just how has he gotten better over the years there?
Yeah, I wrote a big feature about him just a month or so ago during the offseason. He was absolutely not a sure thing. He had two offers coming out of high school to Cincinnati and Eastern Kentucky. He was actually recruited by Tommy Tuberville's staff. He's a fifth-year senior. He redshirted. And Zach Taylor, who is now the head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals, was the quarterback coach at Cincinnati. He was actually the guy who kind of was the lead recruiter on Ridder. They got fired shortly after he committed, and, you know, Fickell and his staff basically did like a tape review and were like, yeah, we're going to keep him. I don't know what the expectations they had for him when they got in, but as Ridder and some, you know, other people on staff tell it, he was like a standout on the scout team his redshirt season. And going into his redshirt freshman season, I mean, I was there, I was watching him in camp and kind of thinking like, this, you know, yeah, this guy's athletic, but he's never going to make it. And the staff was always like, this is the guy. He's a leader. He might not be much of a passer yet, but, you know, when you put him in a game, he's a gamer. He's going to be able to run around. And that it was the first game at UCLA, which at the time no one was picking them to win coming off that 4-8 season. And he went in like the third series and has, you know, never come out since. He's been their starting quarterback. And he's always been athletic, and his dual threat ability is definitely what makes him dangerous, because so many times he's just punished defenses by scrambling or on an RPO, and you know, on a big third down, they'll lock down coverage and he'll just take off and pick up a first down, and it's a gut punch. But his progression and development as a passer is what is going to make him potentially a first round NFL draft pick, because, you know, he's worked on his accuracy. He doesn't make a ton of mistakes, doesn't, you know, make a many bad interceptions. And this season specifically, coming off winning conference offensive player of the year last year, he's improved his deep ball. And that was like the biggest knock against him last year, was they honestly left some points out on the field because he would overthrow, underthrow wide open guys. And this year, I can only think of like one deep ball that stands out through three games that he, you know, overthrew, and he's pretty much been lights out so far in that department. And so when you see every year the progressions he's been able to make, that's why he's gone from being a, you know, three-star who no one wanted coming out of high school to, I don't know where he is in that Heisman conversation, but like you said, you know, I think he's one of the better quarterbacks in college football, and he has a chance to be a first round NFL draft pick, which 4 years ago seemed ridiculous.
This defense has forced 9 turnovers through 3 games. I know it's not a whole lot different, as you said earlier, from what they were doing last year under Marcus Freeman, but I mean, what's Notre Dame really got to be looking out for aside from protecting their quarterback, which they haven't done a great job of so far through 4 games?
Yeah, you know, Pete and I wrote about this. Myjai Sanders, he really hasn't gotten going statistically, a defensive rush end for the Bearcats, but every opposing offense has basically game planned against him and done what they could to keep him out of the backfield. And I'm sure Notre Dame's going to do the same. Marcus is very familiar with Myjai and what he's able to do. So whether he's able to like get sacks or not, you know, I think he had one tackle against Indiana, but his pressure basically forced 2 interceptions. So Notre Dame's going to be game planning against him. In the secondary, like, Sauce Gardner it's not just a cool nickname. He's as good as...
But it is. It is a cool nickname.
It is a cool nickname. That's true. But he's really good. And I don't know how, you know, the way they play Cincinnati, Gardner pretty much always lines up on the boundary side. How does Notre Dame usually do? Will they move guys around? I know Austin's their big
receiver. They move Austin around. Sometimes they'll put Austin even in the slot. I mean, they'll get into alignments where it will be a 3-by-1. But instead of the one being the boundary receiver, it'll actually be Mike Mayer, the tight end. And then in that scenario, Austin would be sometimes play slot. So they'll move him around. I am interested to see the cat and mouse of like, how do you get Sauce Gardner to stay away from Kevin Austin? Because Kevin Austin is like really good athlete, but Sauce Gardner is better than him. Like, that's a matchup that Cincinnati should win. And if that happens, you know, maybe that gets into Cincinnati's defensive alignment. Like, how do they defend Mike Mayer? Like, where are they at linebacker or safety? Because that seems to be like, if Notre Dame's going to have some offensive success, Mayer has to have 12, 13 targets and 8 or 9 catches.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is probably the case for every team that plays Notre Dame, but I think that's easily the biggest concern for Cincinnati is how they defend him. And I'm curious to see how they do it. You know, they have Darian Beavers, who I mentioned is a good weak side linebacker. They kind of play this hybrid sniper position where the Sam linebacker would be somebody like basically a hybrid safety linebacker that plays a little bit deeper. Deshaun Pace and Ty Van Fossen play there. They might be on him. But yeah, you know, how much do they let Sauce, you know, travel with Austin and kind of stick on him, or how much do they just kind of stick to their plan and leave him over there? What impact does that have? And how do they defend against Michael Mayer? Because as good as this defense is, one of the areas like in preseason training camp where the offense had a lot of success was their, you know, Cincinnati's tight ends, Josh Wiley and Leonard Taylor. And, you know, so that would make me think that Michael Mayer has a chance to have a big game. I honestly think the biggest thing will be they have good coverage, you know, for the most part, kind of on the back end and on the outside. Are they able to get to Cone or whoever's playing, you know, quarterback for Notre Dame and kind of prevent them from just finding Mayer over the middle or moving Austin around? And then, you know, honestly, the thing I think Cincinnati might be most vulnerable at on defense is against the inside run, because they play that 3-man front, and Indiana had a lot of success basically running up the gut and making Cincinnati go 4 down to stop them. And coming into the season, I was thinking like that would be a huge advantage for Notre Dame, though, as we've talked about, Notre Dame has not run the ball well. So if they're able to establish any kind of a running game and get Cincinnati out of that three-man front, I think will be interesting, because I think that is an area where the Bearcats can be a little vulnerable.
Justin, you're back and forth with Pete that went up yesterday. You said, I think Bearcat fans are hoping Cone will play. Is that from a strategic standpoint because he's not as mobile as the other guys, or because they want to beat this team at full strength? And can you elaborate if it's a schematic reason?
Yeah, I mean, that's, first of all, that's me maybe projecting. You know, I haven't polled all the Bearcats fans, but I think seeing Cone struggle a little bit, you know, early in the season, and part of that being maybe a lack of mobility. Yeah, I think they view that as they wouldn't, whether it's fans or the team in general, they might not be as worried if Cone is back there, because they've kind of seen what they have with him. Whereas if you're running in some of these younger guys, there's not as much film on them. They're maybe a little bit more mobile. But I think it honestly just goes to some of the struggles Cone has had. Now, again, as I wrote to that thing with Pete, like, that could come back to haunt them if Cone comes out and has a big game. But I don't think there's anything they've seen from Cone that, like, puts a ton of fear into them so far this season. You guys have watched it much closer than I have, so I don't know if that's a fair assessment.
No, I think it's a fair assessment. And you mentioned sort of Cincinnati is weak on interior run defense, like Notre Dame, I think, is weaker in interior run offense. So that may actually be an advantage to Cincinnati, the way Notre Dame is playing. So I guess if Cincinnati gets out of here with a win, like, what are two or three things that, like, have to happen for them to do that?
So the big thing for their slow start against Indiana, they had 5 false starts on the first 7 series. And that's uncharacteristic ideally for any team, but, like, part of it was going into the first real road environment in like 2 seasons. Part of it was they tried to change some things up to combat that, and I think it actually messed them up a little bit more in terms of snap counts and, you know, how they were calling plays in. So assuming they don't get themselves in 3rd and 12s and 3rd and 9s like they did to start the Indiana game, they can't do that again. They can't start that slow against Notre Dame. They can't have turnovers. You know, I think that's a big thing. And again, that's something Desmond Ridder's done really well at. But if they are not putting themselves behind the chains, not giving Notre Dame the ball, which Notre Dame's done a really good job of so far this year, getting takeaways, it keeps them in the game. And their defense is good enough that it's going to give them a chance to stay in it. So, you know, aside from maybe, you know, defense just having some breakdowns and letting some big plays happen, I honestly think the biggest thing is not shooting themselves in the foot on offense, because that'll keep it close. And, you know, at least over the past few seasons with Fickell, like, as long as they're in a game and close, that they've had a lot of success pulling out those types of games.
Justin, important question here. It's been, I think, a month since you did a Bari 3 class with Amy Fickell, the wife of Luke Fickell. Are you fully recovered, and what was that experience like?
It was a life-changing experience. I don't ever intend to do a Bar 3 class or anything like it again. You know, it was one of those things where it's like, in the moment I was, yeah, you know, I'm gonna do it for the story, right? She invited me to come, so I have to do it. But there was a moment in the class where I was like, I might pass out, which might also have been good for the story. It was very intense. I'm certainly not a bastion of physical health anyways. As I told Amy, I'm more of a morning walk type of person. But what I did take a little heart in was, first of all, Luke was there as well, and he was laboring a little bit. But I heard from a few people, like strength and conditioning people and people who just are, you know, work out a lot, who have, like, oh yeah, I did a Bar 3 class with my wife and it just totally wrecked me. So, whatever they have going on, whatever muscles they're working, is just not something my physical capacity has access to. I'm fully recovered, but I don't intend to go back. And now anytime I see, you know, Amy, if she's on the sideline at a game or comes by a practice or something, she's like always teasing me that I need to come back to one with her. And it's not going to happen.
I have to say, like, I love that story. And it made Luke Fickell seem like an incredibly normal person, which is... there are not many normal people at high-level college head coaching. It also made me like, huh, I wonder if he would fit in at Notre Dame, because, like, Notre Dame hasn't rated Cincinnati enough.
Yes, don't bring that up, Cincinnati fans.
I was going to chucking
their phones across the room right now.
But I haven't, like, where, because you went through the courtship with Michigan State, which your story addressed, like, really well and insightfully. Like, Where do you think the end game is for him as a coach? Does he have aspirations beyond Cincinnati? And like, if he does, like, what do you think they might look like?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, and it's something that Cincinnati fans, you know, are still harboring in the back of their minds, because there's always fear, and Bearcat football fans have been conditioned for their coaches to leave, and you know, Brian Kelly's obviously a big piece of that. Fickell has stayed longer than any, you know, Mark D'Antonio, Butch Jones, Brian Kelly, he stayed longer than any of them, and he's kind of shown at this point that he's willing to stay for a long time. He turned down Michigan State very publicly. I can say with confidence there's a lot of other power conference jobs that he's had interest in or been offered that he's turned down over the past few seasons. Getting into the Big 12 is a big deal. Not, you know, Luke's making $3.4 million a year now in his new deal. They've upped his, you know, staff salary, but by moving to the Big 12, all the kind of things he wants to keep doing to move the program forward, facilities, resources, investment, they now have a little bit more access to that. So I think that's going to happen. He, you know, in that story and has been written about a lot with him, like his family's happy here. His son's a freshman on the team. They have six kids and they're happy in Cincinnati. So there's a lot of things that are tethering the Fickells to Cincinnati, including the fact that Lucas spent basically his entire life in the state of Ohio. But there are some obvious destinations where, like, I don't think he'd be able to say no to. Ohio State's the most obvious one. And Notre Dame's an obvious one. He's, you know, the Fickells are devout Catholics, and I don't think there's any question that if that job ever came open, was offered to him, that he would have high serious interest. I do wonder about, like, would he go to Penn State? You know, it was funny when the USC job opened up, because nationally there was all this, like, oh, Mike Bone hired Fickell at Cincinnati and he's at USC. I think Cincinnati fans were more concerned about James Franklin taking the USC job, because then that would open Penn State. I don't really see him as an NFL guy. He likes the team building, recruiting kind of aspect of college football. I'd be surprised, at least anytime soon, if he jumped to the NFL. But yeah, so, you know, if you're looking at Notre Dame, Ohio State, Penn State, okay, how often do those jobs come open, and everybody wants them? So it's no guarantee that even if they did open up, he would be offered them. I'm sure he would be on the short list. But it seems like at this point, you know, those two and maybe Penn State are kind of the ones where it's like that might be the only thing that pulls him away from Cincinnati. And, you know, it makes a little more sense with them going to the Big 12, but I think it might have been the case before. And it kind of just shows how unique of a guy he is that would be the only thing that would pull him away.
The thing about Cincinnati is even the bad coaches move on to big things in life. Senator Tommy Tuberville is a great example of that. I am curious about Luke. Like, you just spent a long time talking about what a unique guy he is. It's almost easy to forget a decade ago this fall, he was thrust into a pretty impossible situation, but he flopped tremendously during his interim stint at Ohio State. It's the worst season of Ohio State football in any of our lifetimes. Again, not an ideal situation to be in, but like, I remember just watching from afar thinking this guy's not head coach material. He looks so overwhelmed. He doesn't seem comfortable in the spotlight. Obviously, the Luke Fickell of 2011 is not the Luke Fickell who took over Cincinnati in 2017 and the guy who's had all the success he's had so far. But what do you think he learned from that experience? And how do you think he didn't let that experience defeat him? Because we've seen a lot of guys in this business step into that spotlight, get overwhelmed, and never really recover.
Yeah, and he's talked a lot about this, how much of an impact that has had on him as a coach. And honestly, it delayed him becoming a head coach somewhere else, because I think he realized how much he had to learn from that experience. And you're right, he was kind of put in an impossible situation. And this is a guy, you know, I realize this makes Cincinnati fans uncomfortable, but he loves Ohio State. And so for him to take over, you know, basically his dream job, but to do it with his mentor, Jim Tressel, kind of being forced out and under this veil of scandal, like, I can't imagine how just emotionally wrecking that must have been for him. And then especially for them to struggle, like, I think it completely ate him up, but it also just impacted him moving forward. And it kind of helped show him what was important to him as a head coach and kind of what he wanted to do. And he took a lot of time after that. You know, I know he had other opportunities, but he was like, I need to make sure wherever I go, it's the right move. And it's a move that makes sense for me and my family. And what was it? So it was at least 5 years after that situation that he went to take on. The thing that gets mentioned less to me that I think is the most interesting about that experience, though, is So he's thrust into this impossible situation. It's the worst season for Ohio State in, you know, however many years. They bring in Urban Meyer, and Urban Meyer kept him on staff. And, like, that was not the original plan. Urban Meyer sat down with him, I think, is almost kind of like a debrief. You know, we're thanks for what you did. We're going to go our separate ways. And he basically came away like, I have to keep this guy on staff as a defensive coordinator because of what he means to the program, of his ability to recruit and his ability to coach. And, you know, I don't know how much Luke thinks about that. From my outside perspective, that shows like just how good of a coach he was, that you go through that and he's still able to stay on staff and have a lot of success there. And yeah, I think the whole thing was a learning experience for him. And that's one of the things I've always been impressed with him. He has not had a lot of missteps since he's been at Cincinnati, but I'm always impressed at when he does have mistakes or they fall short on something, how quickly he's able to like learn from that and not repeat those mistakes. And I think a lot of coaches can be stubborn and, you know, he's very headstrong, but not in the sense that it prevents him from correcting and improving on any kind of shortcomings that they have.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see when he replaces Brian Kelly in 3 years and we can have you back on the podcast. All right. So Saturday, I hate doing predictions as I've been quite upfront about, since when I'm wrong, people give me crap about them for the end of time. And I picked Wisconsin to beat Notre Dame last weekend. So Justin, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What does happen on Saturday? We've talked about why things may happen, but if, as you look ahead to Saturday afternoon, how does it play out?
Yeah, before the season, I picked Cincinnati to lose this game. And part of that is, I think, you know, going into Notre Dame, where, what was it, 26
straight wins.
Yeah, so, and Cincinnati's right behind them on that list. So, like, you know, they understand kind of what it means to defend their home turf. I think that's a really hard thing to do. I think all the storylines that we talked about with Marcus and Mickens and everything, I think that's just going to be a lot emotionally. So I think it's going to be really difficult, you know, even if the two teams are evenly matched, for them to go in and win. But what's changed for me is some of the strengths that I thought Notre Dame would have, specifically running the ball, they haven't had so far this season. And I think there's, I don't know if you say it's a formula, because Cincinnati hasn't really lost much in the past couple of years, but there are areas where I think they are vulnerable or other teams could try to exploit them. And, you know, running the ball up the middle was one of them, and I don't know that Notre Dame's going to be able to do that. I do think getting after Desmond Ridder is going to be, I'm sure, Marcus's game plan, and I think could be a big thing that would give Notre Dame an advantage if they're able to get to him and disrupt him. But based on the way the season has gone so far, I just, and as I wrote in the mailbag, it, you know, the way college football has gone this season, like, it almost seems like things are setting up for Cincinnati to pull out a win. So I think it's going to be really close. I would not be surprised. I'll be more surprised if one side blows the other out as opposed to one side winning. But I'm now leaning and have switched to Cincinnati pulling out a close one in South Bend.
Pete, you're first.
I look at the 25 straight home wins, but I also sort of look at the last 3 years for Notre Dame, where they're 37-5, and the five losses are Clemson, neutral site, Clemson, neutral site, Alabama, neutral site, at Georgia, at Michigan. Like, this game does not fit in that group of the five losses. And I don't know, one of the things that I think I maybe forgot or underrated a little bit, it's just like Notre Dame at the skill positions is really, really good. And that showed against Wisconsin, because Wisconsin was not. Cincinnati's certainly, I think, more athletic than Wisconsin. But when you see Kyron Williams, Mayer, Austin, Tyree, you know, even Lindsey to a certain effect, it's not been effective, but can run by just about anybody, maybe not Sauce Gardner. But I feel like Notre Dame figured some things out last week, and their identity, I did not think was going to link up much for the last 3 years. I almost thought like what happened the previous 3 years was kind of irrelevant to this team because there was so much rebooting going on. But after the way last Saturday played out, I feel like there's much more of a link between the two. So I go Notre Dame 24-23. Like, I think it's going to be an awesome game. And it wouldn't shock me at all if Cincinnati won, but, I think Notre Dame's probably as confident right now as it has been at any point in the year. And I think that's worth at least 1 point on Saturday. So I'll say that makes the difference.
Wow. That was a very specific prediction.
Yes.
Line right now, BetMGM, Cincinnati 2.5, over under 50.5. I don't know if any of us thought Cincinnati would be an outright favorite coming into the season. It's funny you mentioned skill positions, because I thought coming into the season, Notre Dame's going to win this game, because at the end of the day, when it's a Power 5 versus Group of 5 matchup, the Power 5 team is bigger and tougher inside, and that usually wears out the other side. I don't think that's the case right now. I think Cincinnati's the better team, at least on the offensive line, than Notre Dame is. But I do think Notre Dame's skill position players have shown a lot, especially last week. You know, the Cincinnati defense is good. 10th in yards per play, 12th in scoring. On paper, this is a game where I think Cincinnati should win. But I thought the same with Wisconsin last week. And Notre Dame is just, as Pete said, they're in a good spot right now. They're getting more and more confident week by week, to the point where it's really hard to pick against that cohesion and that belief, especially when they're at home and especially when they've been as good as they've been at home. So I've got Notre Dame 31-28. I have a hard time, as Pete said on our previous podcast, I have a hard time picking Notre Dame to lose at this point until they actually do, which I think eventually will come because it's far from a complete team. But I think they're getting better and better defensively, and I think they at least have an understanding of who they are offensively, where they're just going to play to their strengths and find different ways to play to their strengths week after week instead of trying to fit a square peg into a round hole with a run game.
All right. We have a split decision. So I think it'll be a, like you said, I think this will be an awesome game. And we talked about, Matt and I, that, you know, the Wisconsin game was probably the biggest game of the year. Like, this is bigger than that one. You know, maybe it wouldn't have been the case if Notre Dame had lost, but you know, there's so much narrative on Saturday. And like, Cincinnati is really talented. I do think like the Notre Dame fan base in general sort of underrates some of the individual pieces that Cincinnati has because they haven't watched them closely enough. But should be an awesome one on Saturday. Justin and I will be there. Matt, probably watching from a distance on his couch. We'll have a post-game show.
I might have to use Peacock again because YouTube TV and NBC Universal's agreement expires tomorrow night and they've not reached a new deal yet. So I might be way behind again.
Yeah, you may find out who wins on Sunday then. But yeah, it's gonna be an awesome game. You know, kind of one of the biggest games, if not of the season, and there's so much that goes into it. So we will be back on Saturday post-game with a episode of the Shamrock. Perhaps Justin will join us from the press box on that as well. But should be a good one Saturday, 2:30 on NBC if you're fortunate to not have YouTube TV. So I'm Pete, joined as always by Matt Fortuna. Justin, thanks for being on the Shamrock this week, and we will talk to you Saturday post-game of Notre Dame-Cincinnati.